Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Parenthood Podcast. We all know that being a parent can be challenging at the best of times. I distinctly remember struggling to keep my head above the water with two children under two, feeling like the burden of having two such small children with such different needs meant that I couldn't be the mother I wanted to be to them, or the wife, friend, or person I wanted to be. But everything else was good in my life. I'm happily married with a close and healthy family to support me. And while occasionally my back hurts, I had no health concerns, no money concerns. My children were well. So how do people cope when they don't have the stability that I have? Well, with me today, I have someone who I so enjoyed talking to last time that I've persuaded her to come back to the Parenthood. I'm sure many of you listening will remember the Sex Talk podcast that we recorded with Emma Gledhill. That's one of our most popular and talked about episodes. For those who don't, Emma is an educational speaker, trainer and coach who specializes in child and adolescent development, supporting both parents and teachers in the emotional dialogue we have with our children. Emma, welcome back.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, well, it's a real pleasure to have you. So when children come along, they take over our lives. I see it on a daily basis in the bump class. You know, our once tidy houses are transformed into dens of plastic toys. Our daily routine changes. The photos on our phone contain only one subject, our children. And that's for a reason, isn't it? You know, it's important for children to be at the heart of our lives once we have them.
Oh, for sure. It takes over our preoccupations. We talk about having a maternal reverie where there's a, and fathers do this too, where there's an ongoing thinking pattern that is centred on that child. Yeah, we make room for them. And they take it if we don't give it.
They do. But then often, you know, and I slightly defy anyone, we were talking about this earlier, not to have some sort of incident in their life where suddenly the child isn't at the centre. So that status quo gets altered. And obviously this is what we're going to talk about today. What sort of things do sort of impact that status quo and alter that?
I think we have points in our lives where, for instance, our relationships come under strain that might be conflict with our partners, and of course that whole dynamic of changing from being simply a pair to having a third or having four of us, you know, those changes, they impact that foundational relationship. So with every gain of a child, there's also in a way a loss as well of the relationship as it was. Other points of difficulty occur, of course, with illness. When there's an illness that really threatens or destabilizes the family's routine, where a parent is no longer able to work or no longer able to really be physically or mentally as present as they were. And of course, if it's one parent who is ill, then the other parent is also going to be incredibly worried. Then we also have bereavement, and we're tending to have our children a little later, and therefore our grandparents are an ageing population. So again, we can have sudden loss or sudden illnesses at that upper story of the family dynamic. And of course, you know, if we need to zoom in and help an elderly parent who is really in need, then that's where we go into a different sort of form of family survival mode, and it takes our eye away from the children. And of course, that's natural. You know, family life is not going to 100% centre around meeting that child's needs. And it would be damaging if we tried to do that. You know, our children do need to learn how to handle frustration of not being at the centre of the universe. Otherwise, they won't be able to go into group life in school and tolerate being, you know, one of 20, 30 children. So that small periods of that frustration and less availability, they are part of the tapestry of life. But when that's too much for too long and there isn't sufficient dialogue to help the child process what's happening, then those periods of maybe temporary or ongoing loss of the parent and the way the parent was able to parent before the difficulty, before the times got really tough, that's something that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, one of the key things is also kind of separation and divorce and the reforming of families. You know, when one partner then gets married again or has a new boyfriend or girlfriend or partner. And that obviously has a big impact then on children.
Absolutely. And, you know, we know statistically now that one in two children by the age of 15 can expect to be in a home where there has been a separation, some form of family breakdown. So it is prolific in our society. And yet we still have a very adversarial approach to divorce and separation. Someone has to be right and somebody has to be wrong. And the important thing is, where are the children in the mix of that? You know, and I think where there is that loss in the relationship between father and mother, their attachment system has completely changed, because obviously we grow up in our family home, we are attached to our parents and our siblings. We then go through a process through adolescence where we learn to attach to others in our peer group and create meaningful attachments, and then eventually we form a really important attachment, which is the foundation of our next family life, our next experience of family life. And of course, you know, for both partners there, when that attachment is under threat, it's like an earthquake. And each parent can be in a kind of emotional survival mode where either the preoccupation of the loss of that relationship or the conflict surrounding that imminent loss really takes over, and there isn't any real room for that reverie, that important tuning in with the child or children who are also going to have their attachments potentially falling apart too. So we become a little bit more inward looking, and it's hard then to be as observant and as attuned as we might be on those good days. And may those good days last long. But, you know, bad days happen, bad months, bad years happen. And it's how we make sure we've got enough petrol in the tank to show up well for our children, because they are onlookers, but they're also involved in the breakup of a family.
And you know, I think traditionally we look at the breakup of a family as kind of disastrous, but actually it doesn't need to be disastrous. I mean, it can, you know, it's the reforming. And actually, if that's done well and the quality of the relationship is maintained, fine, you may not be married, but that might be the better decision for all parties involved if you are incompatible. But if you still respect and like each other, and the children know that they are still loved by both parents, and both parents, you know, respect each other, that can be not a bad thing.
It doesn't have to be a disastrous thing by any means, but it is going to be a difficult thing. It's going to be an earthquake for the parents. It's going to be an earthquake for the children. But you're right, it's how you rebuild after that quake that really is going to matter. And, you know, children, they need both parents, unless there is a compelling safety reason why not. In other words, that one of those parents presents a physical or an emotional threat to the child, then the children need access to both parents. They also need to understand the story of their family and their reforming family. And often we overlook that need. You know, working with parents who have very young children, for example, the need for even very young children to have some sort of coherent narrative about what has happened in their family life, that why their parents have separated. It has to be age appropriate. It has to be simple for the younger child. But that is a really important thing for example, future attachments. If they're able to understand and process the story of what happened to their family. And in doing so, we clarify some really important problems that I think children automatically have. You know, young children are quite narcissistic and they can quite easily feel that it is their fault. And in fact, whatever age a child is, you know, actually debunking that myth with giving them a clear narrative about what happened. Now, clearly, in some, you know, I know from my teaching career that some family breakups, some issues between couples can be very acrimonious, very difficult for, you know, real good teamwork to take place. But both parties ideally need to be able to give a clear narrative of what happened. Now, those narratives don't need to agree. They don't have to be absolutely enmeshed.
But ideally.
But ideally, if there can be teamwork, if the couple can come together and do teamwork as parents, then that is really helpful.
And passive aggression does not sort of go over the children's heads.
No. It's really important that even from an early age, children do not feel they have to take sides. As I said before, they need to be able to have contact with both parents and have a relationship with both parents and have a narrative about, you know, the parent who stayed and the parent who left and where they fit into that coming and going. And they need to be able to go off and experience the time they have with the other parent, with both parents, in a kind of guilt-free way. And, you know, I do a lot of work with teenagers who kind of feel that when they go off and have their time with one parent and they come back to the other parent, they really feel awkward about talking about the time that they had there. Mm. And yet that's an important part of their life, isn't it?
Yeah, they can't feel that they're, you know, guilty that they're enjoying time with the other parent and that's making mummy sad because I actually had a really nice time with daddy.
Mm. I mean, it takes a lot of generosity on both parents' side to be kind of open to both aspects of their lives. Because what happens as children grow, particularly when they become teenagers, is you know, their task of splitting off from those close family ties. Now that process becomes a little bit more complicated when there's already a split. And I mentioned before that idea of the adversarial legal process of divorce, for example, where one party has to be wrong and one party has to be right. In order for them to navigate those two lives and have an integrated approach to both parents and growing up and becoming an individual who is also separate from both those parents is something that takes quite a lot of time and can be very difficult in any stable family, but a little bit of extra thought, a little bit of extra observation around, you know, and I think for parents to look out for endings and beginnings. So, for example, how their child is showing up when they're saying goodbye to go off and when they're coming back, what their mood is like, any changes there. And so there can be dialogue too, because when a separation is brokered and worked out, and, you know, the spoils of the partnership have been divided, there needs to be really ongoing discussion involving the child increasingly as they grow up as to how contact is working, how well that contact is working. And typically, as young people grow through primary school, particularly into secondary school and through secondary school, their own lives become more independent and more busy too. And will it still work to always have weekends with parent X, who's living in another part of the city or maybe somewhere else in the country, what are they sacrificing when they do that? Does that then discount them from aspects of their own peer attachments that they also need to be able to enjoy? So as well as revisiting the narrative of mummy and daddy separating from an early stage, that needs to be revisited, and so do the sort of contact arrangements as the child grows and changes. And they have different wants and needs too.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
What I think is non-negotiable is the idea that, you know, the child still needs to be in contact with both parents. And quite often, young people do take sides. Mm-hmm. And of course, it can be all too easy for a parent who is wounded through that conflict, through that split up, to actually collude with that.
Yeah, and also for it to be a sort of cheap thrill, essentially, for one party. If your daughter, to feel like your daughter's on your side and you feel really, you know, hurt by what's happened to you, you know, it's quite easy to think, oh, that makes me feel a bit better. But you've got to think, is that really a good thing for her to be feeling? Mm. Or actually, is she going to be the victim at the end of this when it's not her fault at all?
Yes. And in the moment, in those early moments, that may be something that both of you share. And that's kind of okay, but one needs to have an eye on, you know, the exit point from that hurt, and thinking, actually, what's best for my child is that they are able to have that clear, free capacity to love and have a relationship and an ongoing, sustainable relationship with both of us. The fact that that's separately, that is okay, but that is an important thing.
And I suppose there's also the aspect of forgiveness. You know, we lead by example. Children model themselves on us. If we behave a certain way, they're more likely to behave a certain way. And forgiveness is probably one of the hardest things to do as a human, don't you think? And if we can model that it is okay to forgive, it is okay that someone did something bad to you or someone made the wrong decision, someone made a mistake, but that doesn't mean they're a bad person. They made a bad decision, but we can't hold it against them. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of sort of gleaning the positives in a sort of bleak and dark and miserable situation, to sort of lead by example and go, okay, I was really unhappy that this happened, but they are a good person and we still love them is a really important lesson for them to learn.
And it's the, you know, the father or mother that they have is the only one they're going to get. They may have step parents in the future, but they are still their only parent. And, you know, we've also got to remember that as our children grow and individuate, they're going to kick back against us at some point. And so when we're in those sort of darker moments where our teen is really going to be quite assertive, potentially provocative, difficult, about marking out their own territory, getting more independence, that's when we're going to need a parenting partner to stand shoulder to shoulder with us. There's no point one side of the parenting partnership trying to tackle perhaps a dysfunctional attitude towards screens if, you know, three nights a week that work is being completely undone with the other parent. So making sure that the splitting is not going to affect, you know, the splitting of the couple is not going to affect really effective teamwork in parenting, where boundaries and changing boundaries as a child grows are discussed, and you know, certain boundaries are held, certain values are still shared, and both parties, both parents, can still express those with good teamwork.
I think, you know, a lot of people listening to this, something big will have happened, whether it's separation, whether it's bereavement, whether it's a change in circumstances. And that is something they have no control over. And that's a pretty awful situation to be in. You want the best for your children. You think, oh my God, life is wrecking this for us. But one thing you do have control over is how you deal with the situation. And that is what you believe has actually the biggest outcome. You know, divorce doesn't have to be catastrophic. Bereavement doesn't have to, you know, affect your child's personality. It's about how you deal with it and the lessons and the conversations you have with that child at that time.
For sure. And, you know, it's very difficult to get guidance on that, because, you know, a family's deep unhappiness is something that obviously we're apt to share over a glass of wine, etc., between friends, and we want to vent, etc. But really, getting carefully scaffolded good advice about what outcomes you ultimately want, what outcomes will be best for your child. And I would like to recommend some reading matter here. There's a really great book called Understanding the Needs of Children When Parents Separate. And it's by Amelia Dowling and Di Elliott. Both are senior psychotherapists working at the Tavistock Clinic, who have 40 odd years of experience of working with young people through traumatic family separations. And the guidance they put together is really helpful. It's step by step, age by stage. There are links to it on my website.
I'll put it in the episode notes as well.
I think that's a very, very helpful resource for parents to find ways in which they can articulate a narrative of their loss in a way that's objective, constructive, and helpful for their child, in that the child still needs to understand that loss, but understand that they are still loved and that both parents do still care for them, and how that is going to actually take place, how that is going to be organized.
I mean, I think professional advice is something that is really important. I'm a big believer, hence the podcast and getting lots of professionals to come onto the podcast. I find what you find is that you talk to friends, and friends will very often tell you, you know, they'll tell you what they think they want you to hear, what they think will make you feel better. And that might not necessarily be the most productive advice. I think the good thing about talking to a professional, be it whatever's happened to you, is that they will tell you the advice that is helpful and that in the long term will be, you know, useful, rather than what someone who's not professional thinks you might want to hear.
I mean, I think we started this conversation thinking about, you know, when tragedy and difficulty occur, our eye gets taken off the ball where our kids are concerned, a little, sometimes a lot. And how to get our eye back in is actually the aim here. And it may actually only mean a few tweaks, a few good, honest conversations to actually, you know, raise the issue. You know, I've had a really tough time. My father died, you know, a few months ago. And to be able to talk to my daughter, for example, about the way in which that grief hit me and how it also affected, you know, there was a month where I was looking after my mother. She needed a lot of help in that first month. And so it was unprecedented in my family. You know, I've been lucky enough to be able to change my working pattern from being a deputy head who basically lived at school to having the flexibility to be around for my daughter a lot more. And suddenly the rug gets pulled from that. And there was a month where, you know, I was in my own survival mode. And more than that, I was spending most of the time in rural Lincolnshire, 150 miles away. And that was tough. That was tough for all of us. And being able to talk about that and reassure and give my daughter, our children, a platform to talk to their fears. You know, will this happen to you? So that they know that we missed them too. And that although we were hurting and we were in pain about our loss, we still love and care for them. And we are wondering how they are right now too. Because of course, really, our children, they learn love from us. And they learn to love us back. And when they see us in distress, they want to comfort us. And so there's a lot of reverse parenting that's done by even quite young children. And to make sure that they know that, you know, I can be that vulnerable person and I may step into that for a little while, but I'm still mum and I'm still there for you.
Because that will affect every part of their life. If they're struggling emotionally with a parent not being as present as they usually are, you know, their schoolwork, it's not like they can totally disassociate home from school and, you know, leave all that baggage at home when they step into school. And you'll notice, I mean, often as a teacher, you'll probably know this, but that their behaviour at school will often be impacted.
Often, but sometimes not, surprisingly. It's very interesting because, you know, this sort of splitting I've been talking about, an emotional splitting, as well as a splitting, for instance, of a family through chaos or bereavement or disaster or illness. This splitting is a kind of a coping strategy. So someone may be very together at home because they feel they have to show that they're together at home because their parents are upset, or, you know, they recognise that their parents don't maybe have enough petrol in the tank right now. So they may show up in a very orderly way at home, but at school it can fall apart, and vice versa. They can be very orderly at school, and actually school can become a refuge where, you know, they are free of that catastrophe. They can immerse themselves and have fun with their mates like they always did, and actually that's quite important too. But my God, you can feel guilt from that. Mm. You know, you go off, you have your laugh with your friends, and then you realise, but granddad's still dead, or, you know, auntie so-and-so is still in hospital and my cousins must be really worried and my life is just going on. So that's where our attentiveness as parents is really needed, that we watch out for these sort of fears and fantasies growing, and also feelings of guilt and shame that need to be put into a proper frame. It's a perfectly natural process. But I'm glad you raised school, and this is the important thing, and that is to have a good dialogue with the school, that you know who you can go to. If it's a secondary school, whether it's ahead of year, or if you feel it's a rather more private matter, you know, to go to someone who's senior in a pastoral sense. It might be the assistant head or the deputy head, and you can talk to confidentially, and you know, all families have a right to privacy and dignity, and therefore it is very, very possible to talk to the school, tell them what the school needs to know so they can look after the child, and be very clear about who you feel needs to know and who doesn't need to know. So it's not as though it's necessarily something that's going to be broadcast in the staff room and suddenly 120 teachers, they're looking out for your child, but they also know your story. And I think this is something that's really difficult because, of course, you know, if we take the case of a divorce or a separation, it doesn't just happen in one easy hop. There's often months of build up to it. So, again, it's about maybe thinking about what the kids are picking up along the way and being able to actually, as a couple, say, do you know what? This is going to be affecting them. Maybe we should let the school know on that confidential basis that I'm talking about, so that someone there is looking out for them. Teachers see so much and they are a really excellent resource. They see our children every day through a routine. And so when we see, we often pick up on tweaks and changes in a child's behaviour, the way they're showing up, the way they are interacting with other people. We see them, for instance, in registration, which is a kind of the hybrid. It's the sort of legal thing all teachers have to do and do well. But it's that hybrid moment, a transitional time between free time and play and the actual getting down to business. And it's those times where form tutors can see someone in a much less guarded way than when the performance of the lesson begins. So our teachers are amazing resources. A good teacher who's really tuned in will notice and be able to speak up. And again, for parents who are, you know, they've got their own shit to deal with at this point, to know that there is someone else who is also keeping an eye out, who can give you an early warning signal that actually, you know, Fifi may say she's coping at home, but actually there are signs here that we see she's maybe not.
Or conversely, I know it's tough at home, but she seems to be coping really well.
Yeah.
What you're doing it right. Yeah. And that is actually also a really important message to have when you think everything is falling around you. To know that one thing isn't catastrophic.
It is very isolating. These moments feel very isolating. Who will help? And I think, you know, schools generally, teachers generally, are very caring about the children who they see every day. And particularly if there is a little bit of a heads up that something is going on in the background, they can be... There can be excellent teamwork between school and home there.
Yeah. In terms of the impact of a kind of big situation on children of different ages, I mean, obviously that's going to be very different if you've got a 2-year-old or a baby than if you've got a 16-year-old. Broadly speaking, how does it affect each sort of age range? I mean, I'm sort of asking you basically to sort of recite the dictionary. With sort of babies, what do you sort of pick up on? How would they? I mean, you sort of think, well, they can't understand what we're saying.
But God, they can pick so much up, you know. And I think we often underestimate babies and young children. And I would say that there's a very, very famous experiment, still face experiment, with 9-month-old babies, where the mother stops interacting with the child and just presents a very still face for about 2 minutes, and we see the young baby fall apart. In the grand scheme of that baby's life, it's not a big deal, but it is actually quite upsetting to watch the footage of this. And you know, you can find it on YouTube very easily, and it shows us, and it's shown the world of child development research, that actually very young children pick up on emotional vibes and emotional changes. And when a parent, a carer, becomes unresponsive...
Aggressive in any way, just simply unresponsive.
Exactly. That's why it's called the still face experiment. You know, the mother isn't suddenly pulling a nasty face. It is just actually a still, calm face, a neutral face. So it's important for us to remember that even very young children, they will need that narrative. They, you know, and if that divorce, for instance, happened, or that gap in care happened a long time ago, and they were very young, it still needs work later on. So what we might see in a very young child, pre-verbal, 0-2, their possible reactions will be that they are unsettled, or they might be listless, they might be agitated. We might see quite a bit of regression.
What, so in terms of development?
Yes. So a child who previously was walking might stop walking for a little bit and go back to crawling. Or the regression might be in terms of their play. They might retreat to a toy that they... really sort of rely on a toy that was important to them at a younger phase. Sleep disturbance, of course, food refusal, that is often a very good, both of those things are good communication. You know, these big changes in a young child's behaviour, they can be a communication of a need that's not being met. And so being open and curious to what's going on. There may be persistent crying, reverting, wanting a bottle or a dummy, needing comforting, more easily frustrated, you know, the words that they might have been able to use, they stop using. And so, you know, returning to a more babyish state. Now, we also can see, and this is at any stage, we can also see somatic responses where there is a sort of physical response, physical illness, for instance, tummies, heads, etc. And that's quite common.
Yeah. And when the sort of later stage, when they can actually communicate a little bit, when they're sort of approaching five, do they always communicate verbally how they're feeling? Or is it very often their behaviour which is more?
It's often their behaviour which is more. You know, you'll see more clingy behaviour. You'll see, again, that sort of temporary loss of skills. So, for example, not being able to put their shoes on, for example, baby talk. Eating, sleeping, changes again, increased temper tantrums and whining, missing the absent parent, you know, and keeping on going to that point. Where are they? And especially at bedtime, because, of course, you know, when the lights go out, that's another separation, isn't it? They can blame themselves and feel responsible. And sometimes a lot of magical thinking that if parents get back together, so they might start trying to affect that. And sometimes, you know, being ill is a way of rallying both parents around.
Yeah, and getting the attention that they so desperately crave.
So, I mean, what we have there really is a great difficulty of, you know, what vocabulary does a young child have in 3 to 5 to talk about those big feelings? It's going to be quite limited.
Yeah.
So they're going to show it rather than be able to tell it and talk to it. Mm. But it, again, it's in the observation of the patterns. And of course, it's very hard for, you know, for example, a parent who's hurting, a parent who's deeply worried about, you know, for instance, an ill partner, to face a barrage of questions again and again and again, having to go over the same ground again and again and again. And it's where we have to do a lot of self-management and a little bit of self-care to dig that bit extra deeply at bedtime, for instance, where we notice these patterns of clinginess, to be able to cope with it with more objectivity and not sort of lash out. We've got to contain these big feelings, not sort of push them down and push them away and give the child the sort of sense that those feelings are unwanted. Those feelings just are. And it's our job to help them learn how to process those big feelings. So the clinginess can be really difficult because, you know, you're exhausted anyway. And come bedtime, you do just want them to go to sleep because you then may have a little bit of time to come up for air. But that clinginess is showing you something. And I'm not saying that suddenly we should respond to that clinginess by staying endlessly sleeping with them, for example. But we've got to be able to respond to that with some boundaries and kindness. We've got to tune into that clinginess.
And acknowledge that they're feeling vulnerable like you are.
Yes, yes.
For that next stage, you know, once they're sort of in primary school, I mean, when you sort of said what language does a three-year-old have to describe these big feelings, I mean, to be honest, I struggle with that sometimes and I'm 40. Presumably then the language isn't necessarily there even when they've got a much wider vocabulary. So presumably their actions are also very indicative of how they're feeling rather than their vocabulary.
I think this is very true. And even if we think about, you know, older children, for instance, 8-year-olds plus, who have much more range in their expression and also in their cognition, in their ability to, you know, think and you know, understand what's going on, we might be able to tell them a little bit more, but they also become a little bit more inhibited about talking about their vulnerabilities. They become more sensitive to us and our hurt as well. And so often they can present a veneer of coping, which we should not take for granted, actually. And of course, it's very reassuring to think, oh, she's being so brave or he's being so brave and he's coping really well, and to praise that. And of course, I'm not saying that those strengths are not there to be recognised, you know, that our children can be very kind to us and they can be very concerned. But they're still our children, and there needs to be space for them also to be raw, vulnerable, angry, hurt, distraught.
And presumably for that to change day to day, you know, yes. Some days we all find life a bit easier than other days. And yeah. Often you don't know why that is. You just, that's yeah. The way you feel.
And so it's important for us to be ready to catch them in those moments of vulnerability and to encourage them to speak to them so that we can help them process those big feelings. So, yeah, absolutely. The behaviour is often the way in which all of us communicate more clearly a need that's not yet met or a skill that's not yet learned. And of course, the skill of emotion regulation and particularly unbearable emotions like loss, dread, fear. We can learn to suppress them because they become unspeakable.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that for our children, they can be speakable.
And that's presumably as a parent initiating that conversation.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about in a minute about what to do. But as they get older, you know, when they get, we sort of mentioned the teenage years already, when teenagers often push back and they need a villain in their life, and that's very often the parent. How is it manifested in these years? Because also, presumably, they might be young when the trauma occurred, but then they're 16 and they're processing it in a slightly different way than they did. And maybe their behavior is indicative of an earlier experience and it is very much related to that, but the parent might not necessarily associate them together.
Mm. I think being aware, for instance, that the narrative around what happened needs to be revisited at different times. And even if you think, oh my God, you know, we put that to bed when they were seven, and you know, so much life has been lived now where, you know, for instance, my God, they were bridesmaids at my remarriage. But actually being aware that as they grow older, they become, for instance, more aware sexually about what's going on. They become more curious, and also they will be hearing from peers. I mentioned that actually, you know, divorce and family separation is far from isolated. So they'll be seeing it going on in their periphery, and they will be wondering, and they will be creating their own narratives if we don't actually have some dialogue about them. And those narratives can change. So, you know, for instance, in a family where, for instance, there's been maybe an over-identification with one parent's side of the story, suddenly when they're a little bit older, the conversation with the other parent gives them a different insight that lands differently with them at that stage. And suddenly they actually think, ah, I've been blaming you all these years, and now actually I recognise that that was maybe wrong. So actually being really aware that the narrative needs to be consistent, age appropriate, and, you know, moderated by different viewpoints, but given in that coherent, clear way. They don't need to know chapter and verse, and I don't think it is appropriate for us to, you know, convey absolutely everything to our teenagers. But they do need to be able to keep the sort of fantasies that they might develop around a one-sided narrative in check. Because there can, as I say, be that ricocheting between having identified for many years with one parent and then recognising, ah, but I shut out the other when I did that.
And the feeling of guilt.
And a feeling of guilt. So, and that propels a different form of action in the relationships.
It's interesting what you say about that changing perspective. I was talking to a girl recently whose mother left when she was sort of in her 20s. And then when she was 30 or so, she started having children herself. And she said that was the tipping point for her, was she suddenly realized what a big deal her mother, what a big decision it was that her mother could have left her children and left that family dynamic. And it wasn't until she became a mother herself that she then had to totally revisit it and work on the feelings she had around the parent separation that had happened a decade earlier.
Yeah. These things are not really neatly put into a box and put away. So, and it is really important that we're open to that revisiting. We're open to say, you know, do you want to talk about this? I've noticed this. I'm wondering if you're thinking about this. Can we talk about it? Do you want to talk about it? And certainly getting their permission to talk about it, to go about it in that sort of collaborative way, not sort of, you know, I'm going to shine a light in your eyes now and I'm going to sit you down and talk you through this from a slightly older perspective. you know, it's about creating that right moment and really sort of also starting with them as much as possible. You know, what is it that they are, you know, what is it that they're feeling and thinking about the way in which this sort of split family is functioning? How well is it working for them? What questions do they have? And of course, all these moments, these milestones in life always do make us revisit what's happened. So you mentioned the birth of your friend's children, but equally there are, you know, there may be a fairly smooth divorce transaction, as it were, you know, where the parents have acted as a really great team and been really open with the children. But actually the remarriage of either party is another death. It's another acknowledgement that actually it has ended. It really has ended. And of course, when a wedding's about to happen, everyone's got to be happy, happy, happy. So it's very difficult for the growing child who is getting all these messages that it should, you know, isn't this great, to actually go to that parent who perhaps is overjoyed about getting married to a new partner, you know, a new life being born, and actually say, do you know what? I'm feeling really a bit sad about this. So we've got to watch for it. Yeah. Be on the alert for it and open the windows and doors to those conversations. And similarly, then also recognising that, you know, with a remarriage or a repartnering can come another birth, another family. And I think here it really is difficult for teenagers, for example. We look at them, they're so big, they're so capable, you know, they look so sophisticated. But, you know, when those babies come along, they're so cute. They don't have, you know, the flaws, the faults, you know, and our teenagers, you know, they will have forged their own sort of long list of things that they're not so good at by this stage anyway. And along comes this perfect little bouncing baby. Where are they in that family dynamic?
And that's about just about the height of your insecurity, isn't it? Age 16 to 18, mm. where you just doubt your worth and, you know, how much people love you.
And the other side of that is, you know, the maturity is sort of overestimated, and said 16-year-old is suddenly asked to do babysitting detail. Because it's assumed that they will, you know, and again, not working on assumption and actually being ready to talk, you know, I'd love you to babysit, but I'm wondering whether how you're feeling about your baby brother. And, you know, we love the fact that you seem so happy with you know, your new sibling, but
it's okay not to be,
and we have to talk about it if it's not, because I'm also still so here for you.
I think at the heart of it lies communication. You know, if we could communicate really clearly with our children all the way through, life would be so much easier. But I think one of the most important jobs we have as parents is to teach our children to communicate. I mean, God, most of us adults would gladly communicate better. How do we do that? What are the best ways to do it? I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it is to eke out of a sort of insecure 15-year-old how they're really feeling if they really don't want to communicate that with you. Mm. How do you go about that?
I think, you know, it does take a lot of resourcefulness in a parent to truly be present and meet our children where they're really at. And I think it involves our own routines for self-care, particularly when times are hard.
So just looking after ourselves, giving
really
ourselves
looking after
time.
Ourselves. You know, it might feel cathartic to stay up at night nursing a bottle of Chardonnay, you know, watching telly, really trying to look after our sleep, trying to maintain our hobbies or having room for our own, for instance, our own sort of learning and development, whether that's through hobbies we have, making sure that we are still using our relationship network, friends of the family. I think that's really important too, because of course, I mean, I know we've talked a lot about family separations, for example, but often that support network is halved. Mm-hmm. And just because, you know, our children may be really, really friendly with someone who's actually our partner's friend, our partner's workmate, for them to still be able to pursue those friendships. You know, grandparents on the other side, or aunts and uncles on that other side.
Cousins.
We've got to think about, you know, ways in which we can minimise the family conflict and the way that actually decreases our own network of help.
Mm.
Because it's help for us, but it's also really important continuity of other attachments for our child too. So really making sure that we're looking after ourselves, we're thinking about our sleep, we're thinking about, you know, really what things help us refuel. Because it's not enough to just work, and we all work damn hard, and then we work damn hard looking after our children. Simply working on both those fronts and stopping working isn't quite enough to recharge and refuel. So really, you know, and certainly as a coach, this is something that I work on with parents particularly, but also, you know, teachers and school leaders, thinking about what is it, what are the dimensions of what I do in my life that actually put fuel back in the tank and that will help me go at this added level of challenge with more energy and with more more petrol in the tank. Because actually it's they're going to need, you know, in these times of difficulty, they need 100% from us, really. They can't have it all the time, but in little bursts, in little important bursts, they need our 100%. And if we are only running on 50%, all we can give them is 100% of that 50%.
Mm.
And it's not going to be quite enough. So yeah, actually going back to basics, looking after ourselves very carefully so that we've got the ability to, you know, return to being the general on the hill where our children are concerned, where we can actually observe, use our network strategically so that we can actually, of course, we want everything to be okay. And where we see that things are okay, we just think, phew, thank God, at least that's not another, you know, hydra that we have to deal with. But actually, we should still be aware that those big feelings that our kids have, we don't want them to suppress them. Because what we suppress stays with us.
Well, and that leads me on very nicely, you know, how if you're really sad about something, a bereavement, a separation, a tragedy, how emotional should you be in front of your children?
I think there is the need to be authentic, and it is good for our children to see a little bit of vulnerability. And I think at times when we have experienced something catastrophic, it's very difficult to edit that. But I think it's recognising, again, going back to this idea of self-management, to recognise where we are feeling overwhelmed. And sometimes little things can trigger that, can't they? It might be a song on the radio. It might be watching something on TV. You know, you think you're watching a film that's perfectly neutral that you can see with your children, and then, bam, Disney do it again. Mm. You know, and you well up and you tear up. It brings a loss afresh. And I think it's really important that they see that happen, but they also see, you know, that we talk to that. You say, oh, that's really got me right now.
Mm.
Oh, but it's okay. Just give me a moment. I'll be okay. And then making sure we reconnect with them, often by touch, by looking at them. You know, and sometimes when, you know, I certainly remember as a deputy head, talking to parents and children and teachers in extremis, how often people would apologise for their tears.
Mm.
Don't apologise for your tears. They exist. They're real. Acknowledge them, but say, I'm going to be all right in a moment. Just, you know, give me a second. Let them see you. Breathe deeply. Do those, you know, heart expanding sighs, exhalations. They really do help that broken hearted feeling. Because when we do that, we're modelling to them, yes, I can feel, I can be really vulnerable, but there are things I can do about it. I can talk about it. I can let it be. I can let it go, and then I can decide what else I'm going to let in,
yeah,
in its place.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of three-part structure to dealing with tragedy, overwhelm, big feelings, even just disappointment.
Mm.
You know, let it be, let it actually happen, and have that emotional moment, have the feeling.
Because it's much harder to hold it all in than to let it all out. I mean, I must say, I know from having experienced grief myself, that sort of, sometimes I just need to have a really good cry. And then I feel so much better. Mm. And that 2 minutes of crying will suddenly release a huge amount that needed to be released.
Yes.
Whereas if you're thinking, I can't cry in front of my children, then that makes it so much harder. I mean, I must say, in my experience, the first time I cried in front of my children after our son was stillborn, I was really worried about it. But I think it was a good thing to do because it enabled us to have a really honest conversation. And it also showed them that if I cried, it really wasn't the end of the world. They now see mummy crying quite a bit and they know that it'll be over. And, you know, they've learned that that's not a disaster. Whereas if you never see your children crying, I suppose they also learn from you that it's not okay to show your emotions. It's not okay to show that you're vulnerable and that sometimes you aren't so strong. I think that's a really important lesson to learn.
I totally agree. It's important for them to see us modelling that idea of being able to have our emotional experience, to name it as well. Because once we name it, you know, I'm a bit overwhelmed at the moment, or I feel like really shouting right now. Actually, the moment of identifying it is also another form of release. And it also signals to our minds, you know, like, geez, I'm really tired right now. I'm so tired I could drop. And almost the moment you've identified it, your brain is already leaping to the next stage, which is a little bit of self-care. So I'll go a little bit easier on X, Y, and Z. Mm. Yeah. So really modelling, having the feeling, naming the feeling, actually stopping and understanding that feeling. And so the more we actually articulate it and put it into words, and then we've already climbed down from those big tsunami waves of emotion by doing so, and we start to make it seem more livable. It's natural to have big reactions, but, you know, the more we develop as sociable beings, we learn to, you know, not cry. You know, how soon do we teach our children to not be a crybaby, to not be angry, to, you know, to not kick, scratch or bite? There are all these ways in which we sort of model an idea that control is really important. But if we only present a strong, controlled front to our children, they don't see the work being done behind the scenes. And maybe we're not actually doing that work either. So we're not modelling working through emotions. And our children learn how to be emotionally agile primarily through that dialogue with parents.
I think that's a really positive note to end on, I've got to say. I think, you know, often when you're kind of faced with a big deal in your life and you think, oh my God, my poor children, and how they're going to deal with this, and I, you know, you feel sort of responsible that you're exposing them to sort of divorce or trauma or sadness or bereavement, but actually our job as a parent is to teach them how to navigate life, and life is never perfect. They're going to come up against their own obstacles the same way, and actually if we can use their childhood to teach them how to deal with the slings and arrows that life is going to inevitably chuck their way, then we've done an amazing job as a parent. So actually sort of turning that round and thinking, I'm going to use this tricky situation to teach you how to deal with it and hopefully become closer as a family unit and develop skills that you wouldn't have had the opportunity to develop if life rolled along just perfectly.
For sure. And I think that's about empowering ourselves in the midst of disaster, isn't it?
Yeah. Amazing. That definitely is going to be the title of this. Empowering ourselves in the midst of disaster. What a perfect, perfect thing to end on. Emma, thank you so much. It's been so lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. If you're keen to hear more about Emma, do have a listen to the other podcast she's done for us and have a look at her website. It's emmagledhill.com, where you'll find further information about the parent talks and workshops she does. Really, really worth a look at that. And thank you all for downloading another episode of The Parenthood. We are now a year old. We've completed a whole year of podcasts, which, according to the feedback you're all sending me, are really helpful, enjoyable, and eye-opening. We consistently top the iTunes charts, for which I couldn't be prouder of. And it's all thanks to you, listeners. So please do continue to subscribe, rate, and review us. You can follow us on Instagram at theparent.hood or me at marina.fogel. But in the meantime, from Emma and me, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.